for the change, but I was convinced it was because Eric had detected her inner ferocity. On an impulse, I said, "Pam, do you ever wonder what would have happened to you if you hadn't met up with Eric?" There was a long silence, or at least it seemed long to me. I wondered if she was angry or sad about her lost chance for a husband and children. I wondered if she was looking back with longing on her sexual relationship with her maker, Eric, which, like most vampire-vampire relationships, hadn't lasted long, but had surely been very intense. Finally, just when I was going to apologize for asking, Pam said, "I think I was born for this." The faint light from the dashboard illuminated her perfectly symmetrical face. I would have been a dismal wife, a terrible mother. The part of me that has taken to slashing the throats of my enemies would have surfaced if I'd remained human. I wouldn't have killed anyone, I suppose, because that wasn't on my list of things I could do when I was human. But I would have made my family very miserable. You can be sure of that. "You're a great vampire," I said, since I couldn't think of anything else to say. She nodded. "Yes, I am." We didn't speak again until we reached Eric's house. Oddly enough, he'd bought a place in a gated community with a strict building code. Eric liked the daytime security of the gate and the guard, and he liked the fieldstone house. There weren't too many basements in Shreveport because the water level was too high, but Eric's house was on a slope. Originally, its downstairs was a walk-in from the back patio. Eric had had that door pulled out and the wall made solid, so he had a great place to sleep. Until we'd become blood-bonded, I'd never been to Eric's house. Sometimes it was exciting being so closely yoked with Eric, and sometimes it made me feel trapped. Though I could scarcely believe it, the sex was even better now that I'd recovered, at least in large part, from the attack. At this moment, I felt like every molecule in my body was humming because I was near him. Pam had a garage door opener, and she pressed it now. The door swung up to reveal Eric's car. Other than the gleaming Corvette, the garage was spotless. No lawn chairs, no bags of grass seed or half-empty paint cans, no stepladder or coveralls or hunting boots. Eric didn't need any of these accoutrements. The neighborhood had lawns, pretty lawns, with rigidly planted and mulched flower beds, but a lawn care service trimmed every blade of grass there, pruned every bush, raked every leaf. Pam got a kick out of closing the garage door once we were inside. The kitchen door was locked, and she used a key so we could pass from the garage into the kitchen. A kitchen is largely useless to a vampire, though a little refrigerator is necessary for the synthetic blood, and a microwave is handy to heat it to room temperature. Eric had bought a coffee maker for me, and he kept some food in the freezer for whatever human was in the house. Lately, that human had been me. "Eric!" I called when we came through the door. Pam and I took off our shoes, which was one of Eric's house rules. "Oh, go get your greeting over with," Pam said when I looked at her. "I've got some True Blood and some life support to put away." I passed from the sterile kitchen into the living room. The kitchen colors were bland, but the living room echoed Eric's personality. Though it wasn't often reflected in his clothing, Eric harbored a love of deep colors. The first time I'd been to his house, the living room had surprised the hell out of me. The walls were a sapphire blue, the crown molding and baseboards a pure, gleaming white. The furniture was an eclectic collection of pieces that had appealed to him, all upholstered in jewel tones, some intricately patterned, deep red, blue, the yellow of citrine, the greens of jade and emerald, the gold of topaz. Since Eric is a big man, all the pieces were big. Heavy, sturdy, and strewn with pillows. Eric came out of the doorway to his home office. When I saw him, every hormone I had stood to attention. He's very tall, his hair is long and golden, and his eyes are so blue the color practically pops out of the whiteness of his face, a face that is bold and masculine. There's nothing epicene about Eric. He wears jeans and t-shirts mostly, but I've seen him in a suit. GQ missed a good thing when Eric decided his talents lay in building a business empire rather than modeling. Tonight, he was shirtless, sparse, dark gold hair trailing down to the waist of his jeans and gleaming against his pallor.
"Jump,"
Eric said, holding out his hands and smiling. I laughed. I took a running start and leaped. Eric caught me, his hands clamped around my waist. He lifted me up until my head touched the ceiling. Then he lowered me for a kiss. I wrapped my legs around his torso, my arms around his neck. We were lost in each other for a long moment. Pam said,
"Back to Earth, monkey girl. Time is passing."
I noted that she was blaming me and not Eric. I pulled away and gave him a special smile.
"Come, sit, and tell me what's wrong," he said. "Do you want Pam to know, too?"
"Yes," I said. I figured he'd tell her anyway. The two vampires sat at opposite ends of the dark red couch, and I sat across from them on the gold and red love seat. In front of the couch was a very large square coffee table with inlaid woodwork on the top and elaborately carved legs. The table was scattered with things Eric had been enjoying recently, the manuscript of a book about the Vikings that he'd been asked to endorse, a heavy jade cigarette lighter, though he didn't smoke, and a beautiful silver bowl with a deep blue enamel interior. I always found his selections interesting. My own house was kind of cumulative. In fact, I hadn't picked out anything in it but the kitchen cabinets and appliances. But my house was the history of my family. Eric's house was the history of Eric. I brushed a finger across the inlaid wood. "Day before yesterday," I began, "I got a call from Alcide Hervaux." I wasn't imagining that the two vampires had a reaction to my news. It was minute. Most vampires aren't given to extravagant expressions, but it was definitely there. Eric leaned forward, inviting me to continue my account. I did, telling them that I'd also met some of the new additions to the Longtooth Pack, including Basim and Annabelle.
"I've seen this Basim," Pam said. I looked at her with some surprise. "He came to Fantasia one night with another ware, another new one. That Annabelle, the brown-haired woman, she's Alcide's new squeeze."
Though I'd suspected as much, it was still a little astonishing to me. "She must have hidden assets," I said, before I thought. Eric raised an eyebrow.
"Not what you thought Alcide would pick, my lover?"
"I liked Maria Starr," I said. "Like so many other people I'd met in the past 2 years, Alcide's previous girlfriend had met an awful end. I'd grieved for her."
"But before that, he had long associated with Debbie Pelt," Eric said, and I had to struggle to control my face. "You can see that Alcide's Catholic in his pleasures," Eric continued. "He carried the torch for you, didn't he?"
Eric's slight accent made the outmoded phrase sound exotic.
"From a true bitch, to a startling talent, to a sweet photographer, to a tough girl who doesn't mind visiting a vampire bar. Alcide has very variable taste in women."
That was true. I'd never put it together before.
"He sent Annabelle and Basim to the club for a purpose. Have you been reading the newspapers lately?"
Pam asked. "No," I said. "I've been enjoying not reading the papers."
"Congress is thinking of passing a bill requiring all the werewolves and shifters to register. Legislation and issues regarding them would then fall under the Bureau of Vampire Affairs, as laws and lawsuits pertaining to us, the undead, do now."
Pam was looking very grim. I almost said, "But that's not right." Then I understood how that would sound, as if I thought it was okay to require the vampires to register, but wares and shifters shouldn't have to. Thank God I didn't open my mouth.
"Not too surprisingly, the wares are furious about this. In fact, Alcide has told me himself that he thinks the government has sent people to spy on his pack, the idea being that they would then give some kind of secret report to the people in Congress who are considering this bill. He doesn't believe it's only his pack that's being singled out. Alcide has good sense."
Eric sounded approving.
"But he believes he's being watched."
Now I understood why Alcide had been so concerned about the people camping on his land. He'd suspected they weren't what they appeared to be. "It would be awful to think your own government was spying on you," I said. especially after you've been thinking of yourself as a regular citizen your entire life. The enormity of the impact of this piece of legislation was still sinking in. Instead of being a respected and wealthy citizen in Shreveport, Alcide and the other members of his pack would become like illegal aliens. Where would they have to register? Could the kids still go to school with all the other children? What about the men and women at Barksdale Air Force Base? After all these years, do you think the bill really has a chance of passing? Pam said,
The Wares believe it does. Maybe it's paranoia. Maybe they've heard something through the members of Congress who are two-natured. Maybe they know something we don't know. Alcide sent this Annabel and Basim al-Saud to tell me they might be in the same boat with us soon. They wanted to know about the area representative for the BVA, what kind of woman she is, how they could deal with her.
Who is the rep? I asked. I felt ignorant and ill-informed. Obviously, I should have known this, since I was intimately involved with a vampire.
Catherine Boudreau, Pam said. She likes women somewhat more than men, like I do. Pam grinned a toothy grin. She also loves dogs. She has a steady lover, Sally, who shares her house. Catherine is not interested in having a side affair, and she is unbribable.
You've tried, I take it.
I tried to interest her sexually. Bobby Burnham tried the bribe.
Bobby was Eric's daytime man. We disliked each other intensely. I took a deep breath. Well, I'm real glad to know all this, but my real problem came after the Wares used my land.
Eric and Pam were looking at me sharply and with great attention all of a sudden. You let the Wares use your property for their monthly run?
Well, yeah. Hamilton Bond said there were people camping out on the Hervo land, and now that I've heard what Alcide's told you, and I'm wondering why he didn't tell me all this, I can see why he didn't want to have a run on his own land. I guess he thought the campers were government agents. What would the new agency be called? I asked.
It wouldn't be BVA, would it? If the BVA was still only representing vampires.
Pam shrugged.
The legislation going through Congress proposes it be called the Bureau of Vampire and Supernatural Affairs. Get back to your issues, my lover, Eric said.
Okie dokie. Well, when they were leaving, Basim came to the front door and told me he'd smelled at least one fairy and some other vampire traveling through my land, and my cousin Claude says he wasn't the fairy. There was a moment of silence.
Interesting, Eric said. Very odd. Pam said.
Eric ran his fingers over the manuscript on the coffee table as if it could tell him who'd been traipsing around my property.
I don't know the credentials of this Basim, except that he was thrown out of the pack in Houston and Alcide took him in. I don't know why he was expelled. I expect it was for some disruption. We'll check on what Basim told you.
He turned to Pam.
That new girl, Heidi, says she's a tracker.
You got a new vamp? I asked.
This is one sent to us by Victor.
Eric's mouth was set in a grim line.
Even from New Orleans, supposedly, Victor is running the state with a tight hand. He sent Sandy, who was supposed to be the liaison, back to Nevada. I suspect Victor thought he didn't have enough control over her.
How can he get New Orleans up and running if he travels around the state as much as Sandy did?
I'm assuming he's leaving Bruno Brazel in charge, Pam said. I think Bruno pretends Victor is in New Orleans, even when Victor isn't. The rest of Victor's people don't know where he is half the time. Since he killed off all the New Orleans vampires he could find, we've had to rely on the information of our one spy who survived the massacre.
Of course, I wanted to veer off and discuss the spy. Who would be that brave and reckless to spy for Eric in the bailiwick of his enemy? But I had to stick to the main subject, which was the sneakiness of Louisiana's new regent head honcho. So, Victor likes to be in the trenches, I said, and Eric and Pam looked at me blankly. Older vampires don't always have a complete grasp of the vernacular. He likes to see for himself and do for himself, rather than rely on the chain of command, I explained.
Yes, Pam said. And the chain of command can be quite heavy and literal under Victor.
Pam and I were talking about Victor on the drive over here. I wonder why Felipe DeCastro chose Victor to be his representative in Louisiana. Victor had actually seemed okay the two times I'd met him face to face, which only went to show that you can't judge a vampire by his good manners and his smile.
There are two schools of thought about that, Eric said, stretching his long legs out in front of him.
I had a flash of how those long legs looked spread wide on crumpled sheets, and I forced my mind back to the current subject of discussion. Eric gave me a fangy smile. He knew what I was feeling before he continued.
One is that Felipe wants Victor as far away as he can get him. I believe that Felipe feels that if he gives Victor a big chunk of red meat, he won't be tempted to try to snatch the whole steak.
While others of us, Pam said, think that Felipe simply appointed Victor because Victor is very efficient, that Victor's devotion to Felipe is possibly sincere.
If the first theory is correct, Eric said, there isn't perfect trust between Felipe and Victor.
If the second theory is correct, Pam said, and we act against Victor, Felipe will kill us all. I'm getting your drift, I said, looking from first theory, shirtless with blue jeans, to second theory, cute vintage suit. I hate to sound really selfish, but the first thought that popped into my mind is this. Since Victor wouldn't let you come to help me when I needed you, and incidentally I know I owe you big time, Pam, that means Victor's not honoring the promise, huh? Felipe promised me that he would extend his protection to me, which he ought to have, because I saved his life, right? There was a significant pause while Eric and Pam considered my question.
I think Victor will do his best not to openly cause you harm, until and if he decides to try to become king in his own right, Pam said. If Victor decides to make a grab for the kingship, all promises made by Felipe are so many words without meaning.
Eric nodded in agreement. That's just great. I probably sounded petulant and selfish because that was the way I felt.
This is all assuming we don't find a way to kill him first,
Pam said quietly. And we were all silent for a long moment. There was something that creeped me out, no matter how much I agreed that Victor should die, about the three of us talking about murdering him. And you think this Heidi, who's supposed to be such a great tracker, is here in Shreveport to be Victor's eyes and ears? I said briskly, trying to throw off the chill that had fallen on me.
Yes, said Pam, unless she's here to be Felipe's eyes and ears, so Felipe can keep track of what Victor is doing in Louisiana.
She had that ominous look on her face, the one that said she was going to get her vampire game on. You did not want Pam to look that way when your name entered the conversation. If I were Heidi, I would take care to keep my nose clean. Heidi, which conjured up braids and full skirts in my imagination, seemed like a very perky name for a vampire. So what should I do about the Longtooth Pack's warning? I said, to bring the discussion back to the original problem. You're gonna send Heidi to my place to try to track the fairy? I have to tell you something else. Basim scented a body, not a fresh one, buried very deep at the back of my property.
Oh, Eric said. Whoops.
Eric turned to Pam.
Give us some alone time.
She nodded and went out through the kitchen. I heard the back door shut.
Eric said, I'm sorry, my lover. Unless you've buried someone else on your property and kept it from me, that body is Debbie Peltz.
That was what I'd been afraid of. Is the car back there, too?
No, the car is sunk in a pond about 10 miles south of your place.
That was a relief. Well, at least it was a werewolf who found it, I said. I guess we don't have to worry about it, unless Salcede can identify her scent. They won't go digging the body up. It's none of their doings. Debbie had been Alcide's ex-girlfriend when I'd had the misfortune to meet her. I don't want to drag out the story, but she'd tried to kill me first. It took me a while, but I'm over the angst of her death. Eric had been with me that night, but he hadn't been in his right mind, and that's yet another story.
Come here,
Eric said. His face held my very favorite expression, and I was doubly glad to see it because I didn't want to think too much about Debbie Pelt.
What will you give me if I do?
I gave him a questioning eye.
I think you know very well what I will give you. I think you love me to give it to you.
So, you don't enjoy it at all? Before I could blink, he was on his knees in front of me, pushing my legs apart, leaning in to kiss me.
I think you know how I feel, he said in a whisper. We are bonded. Can you believe I'm not thinking of you while I work? When my eyes open, I think of you, of every part of you.
His fingers got busy, and I gasped. This was direct, even for Eric.
Do you love me?
He asked, his eyes fixing mine. This was a little difficult to answer, especially considering what his fingers were doing.
I love being with you, whether we're having sex or not. Oh, God, do that again. I love your body. I love what we do together. You make me laugh, and I love that. I like to watch you do anything.
I kissed him, long and lingeringly.
I like to watch you get dressed. I like to watch you undress. I like to watch your hands when you're doing this to me. Oh!
I shuddered all over with pleasure. When I'd had a moment of recovery, I murmured,
If I asked you the same question, what would your answer be?
I would say exactly the same thing,
Eric said.
And I think that means I love you. If this is not true love, it's as close as anyone gets. Can you see what you've done to me?
He didn't really have to point. It was pretty damn obvious.
That looks painful. Would you like me to nurse it?
I asked in the coolest voice I could manage. In reply, he simply growled. We switched places in an instant. I knelt in front of Eric, and his hands rested on my head, stroking. Eric was a sizable guy, and this was a part of our sex life that I'd had to work on. But I thought I was getting pretty good at it, and he seemed to agree. His hands tightened in my hair after a minute or two, and I made a little noise of protest. He let go and gripped the couch instead. He growled deep in his throat.
Faster, he said. Now, now!
He shut his eyes, and his head fell back, his hands opening and closing spasmodically. I loved having that power over him. That was another thing I loved. Suddenly, he said something in an ancient language, and his back arched, and I moved with increased purpose, swallowing down everything he gave me. And all this with most of our clothes on.
Was that enough love for you?
He asked, his voice slow and dreamy. I climbed into his lap and wound my arms around his neck for an interlude of cuddling. Now that I'd recovered my pleasure in sex, I felt limp as a dish rag after a session with Eric. But this was my favorite part, though it made me feel very women's magazine to admit it. As we sat holding each other, Eric told me about a conversation he'd had with a fang banger at the bar, and we laughed about it. I told him about how torn up Hummingbird Road was while the parish was patching it. I suppose this is the kind of thing you talk about with someone you love. You figure they'll care about trivial topics, since those things are important to you. Unfortunately, I knew that Eric had more business to get through that night, so I told him I'd go back to Bon Ton with Pam. Sometimes I stayed at his place, reading while he worked. It's not easy to arrange alone time with a leader and businessman who's awake only during the hours of darkness. He gave me a kiss to remember him by.
I'll send Heidi to you, probably night after next, he said. She'll verify what Basim says he smelled in the woods. Let me know if you hear from Alcide.
When Pam and I left Eric's house, it had started raining. The rain put a little chill in the air, and I turned the heat on low in Pam's car. It wouldn't make any difference to her. We drove for a while in silence, each lost in our own thoughts. I watched the windshield wipers fan back and forth. Pam said,
You didn't tell Eric about the ferry staying with you.
Oh, gosh!
I put my hand over my eyes.
No, I didn't. There was so much else to talk about, I completely forgot.
You realize Eric won't like another man living in the same house with his woman.
Another man who is my cousin and also gay.
But very beautiful and a stripper.
Pam glanced over at me. She was smiling. Pam's smiles are somewhat disconcerting.
You can strip all you want to. If you don't like the person you're looking at while you're naked, it's not going to happen, I said tartly.
I kind of understand that sentence, she said after a moment. But still, having such an attractive man in the same house, it's not good, Sookie.
You're kidding me, right? Claude is gay. Not only does he like men, he likes men with beard stubble and oil stains on their blue jeans.
What does that mean? Pam said.
That means he likes blue-collar guys who work with their hands or their fists.
Oh, interesting.
Pam still had an air of disapproval. She hesitated for a moment, then said,
Eric hasn't had anyone like you in a long, long time, Sookie. I think he's level-headed enough to keep on course, but you have to consider his responsibilities. This is a perilous time for the few of us in his original crew remaining since Sophie Anne met her final death. We Shreveport vampires doubly belong to Eric, since he's the only surviving sheriff from the old regime. If Eric goes down, we all go down. If Victor succeeds in discrediting Eric or somehow eating into his base here in Shreveport, we'll all die.
I hadn't put the situation to myself in terms that dire. Eric hadn't spelled it out to me either. It's that bad? I said, feeling numb.
He is male enough to want to look strong in front of you, Sookie. Truly, Eric's a great vampire and very practical, but he isn't practical nowadays, not when it comes to you.
Are you saying you don't think Eric and I should see each other anymore? I asked her directly. Though generally I was very glad that vampire minds were closed to me, sometimes I found it frustrating. I was used to knowing more than I wanted to know about how people were thinking and feeling, rather than wondering if I was right.
No, not exactly.
Pam looked thoughtful.
I would hate to see him unhappy, and you too, she added as an afterthought. But if he's worried about you, he won't react the same as he would, as he should,
if I weren't in the picture. Pam didn't say anything for a while. Then she said,
I think the only reason Victor hasn't abducted you to hold you over Eric is because Eric married you. Victor's still trying to cover his ass by doing everything by the book. He isn't ready to rebel against Felipe openly. He'll still try to show justification for whatever he does. He's walking on thin ice with Felipe right now because he almost let you get killed.
Maybe Felipe will do the job for us, I said. Pam looked thoughtful.
That would be ideal, she said, but we'll have to wait for it. Felipe is not going to do anything rash when it comes to killing a lieutenant of his. That would make his other lieutenants uneasy and uncertain.
I shook my head. That's too bad. I don't think it would bother Felipe very much at all to kill Victor.
And it would bother you, Sookie?
Yes, it would bother me, though not as much as it ought to.
So, if you could do it in a rush of rage when Victor was attacking you, that would be far preferable to planning a way to kill him when he couldn't fight back effectively.
Okay, put like that, my attitude didn't make much sense. I could see that if you were willing to kill someone, planning to kill someone, wishing someone would die, quibbling about the circumstances was ridiculous.
It shouldn't make a difference, I said quietly.
But it does. Victor has to go, though.
You've changed,
Pam said after a little silence. She didn't sound surprised or horrified or disgusted. For that matter, she didn't sound happy. It was more as though she'd realized I'd altered my hairstyle.
Yes,
I said. We watched the rain pour down some more. Suddenly Pam said, Look! There was a sleek, white car parked on the shoulder of the interstate. I didn't understand why Pam was so agitated until I noticed that the man leaning against the car had his arms crossed over his chest in an attitude of total nonchalance, despite the rain. As we drew abreast of the car, Alexis, the figure, waved a languid hand at us. We were being flagged down.
Shit, Pam said. That's Bruno Brazel. We have to stop.
She pulled over to the shoulder and stopped in front of the car.
And Corinna, she said, sounding bitter.
I glanced in the side mirror to see that a woman had gotten out of the Lexus.
They're here to kill us, Pam said quietly. I can't kill them both. You have to help.
They're gonna try to kill us?
I was really, really scared.
That's the only reason I can think of that Victor would send two people on a one-person errand, she said.
She sounded calm. Pam was obviously thinking much faster than I was.
Showtime! If the peace can be kept, we need to keep it, at least for now. Here!
She pressed something into my hand.
Take it out of the sheath. It's a silver dagger.
I remembered Bill's gray skin and the slow way he moved after silver poisoning. I shuddered, but I was angry with myself for my squeamishness. I slid the dagger from the leather sheath.
We have to get out, huh?
I said. I tried to smile.
Okay. Showtime.
Suki, be brave and ruthless, Pam said, and she opened her door and disappeared from sight.
I sent a last waft of love toward Eric by way of goodbye while I was sticking the dagger through my skirt's waistband at the back. I got out of the car into the pelting darkness, holding my hands out to show they were empty. I was drenched in seconds. I shoved my hair behind my ears so it wouldn't hang in my eyes. Though the Lexus's headlights were on, it was very dark. The only other light came from oncoming headlights from both sides of the interstate and the brightly lit truck stop a mile away. Otherwise, we were nowhere, an anonymous stretch of divided interstate with woods on either side. The vampires could see a lot better than I could. But I knew where everyone was because I cast out that other sense of mine and felt for their brains. Vampires register as holes to me, almost black spots in the atmosphere. It's negative tracking. No one spoke, and the only noise was the pelting of the rain drumming on the cars. I couldn't hear an oncoming vehicle.
Hi, Bruno,
I called, and I sounded perky in a crazy way.
Who's your buddy?
I walked over to him. Across the median, a car whizzed by going west. If the driver caught a glimpse of us, it probably looked as though two good Samaritans had stopped to help some people with car trouble. Humans see what they want to see, what they expect to see. Now that I was closer to Bruno, I could tell that his short brown hair was plastered to his head. I'd seen Bruno only once before, and he was wearing the same serious expression on his face that he'd worn the night he'd been standing in my front yard, ready to move in and burn down my house with me in it. Bruno was a serious kind of guy. In the same way, I'm a perky kind of woman. It was a fallback position.
Hello, Miss Stackhouse, Bruno said.
He wasn't any taller than me, but he was a burly man. The vampire Pam had called Corinna loomed up on Bruno's right. Corinna was, had been, African-American, and the water was dripping off the tips of her intricately braided hair. The beads worked into the braids clicked together, a sound I could just pick up under the drumming of the rain. She was thin and tall, and she'd added to her height with 3-inch heels. Though she was wearing a dress that had probably been very expensive, her whole ensemble had suffered by the drenching it had taken. She looked like a very elegant, drowned rat. Since I was almost out of my head with alarm anyway, I started laughing.
You got a flat tire or something, Bruno?
I asked.
I can't imagine what else you'd be doing out here in the middle of nowhere in the pouring rain.
I was waiting for you, bitch.
I wasn't sure where Pam was, and I couldn't spare the brain power to search for her.
Language, Bruno! I don't think you know me well enough to call me that. I guess you all have someone watching Eric's house.
We do. When we saw you two leaving together, it seemed like a good time to take care of a few things.
Corinna hadn't spoken still, but she was looking around her warily, and I realized she didn't know where Pam had gone. I grinned.
For the life of me, I don't know why you're doing all this. It seems like Victor should be glad to have someone as smart as Eric working for him. Why can't he appreciate that?
And leave us alone.
Bruno took a step closer to me. The light was too poor for me to make out his eye color, but I could tell he was still looking serious. I thought it was strange when Bruno took the time to answer me, but anything that bought us more time was good.
Eric is a great vampire, but Eric will never bow to Victor, not really. And he's accumulating his own power at a pace that makes Victor anxious. He's got you, for one thing. Your great-grandfather may have sealed himself away, but who's to say he won't come back? And Eric can use your stupid ability whenever he chooses. Victor doesn't want Eric to have that advantage.
And then Bruno had his hands around my neck. He'd moved so quickly, I couldn't possibly react, and I knew vaguely over the pounding in my ears that there was a sudden and violent commotion going on to my left. I reached behind me to pull the knife, but we were suddenly down in the tall, wet grass at the edge of the shoulder, and I kicked my leg up and over and pushed, trying to get on top. I kind of overdid it, because we began rolling down into the drainage ditch. That was a pity, because it was filling with water. Bruno couldn't drown, but I sure could. Wrenching my shoulder with the force of my effort, I yanked the knife out of my skirt when I rotated to the top, and as we rolled yet again, I saw dark spots in front of my eyes. I knew this was my last chance. I stabbed Bruno up under his ribs, and I killed him.
Chapter 4.
Pam yanked Bruno's body off me and rolled him all the way down into the water coursing through the ditch. She helped me up.
"Where were you?"
I croaked.
"Disposing of Corinna," literal-minded Pam said. She pointed to the body lying by the white car. Fortunately, the corpse was on the side of the car concealed from the view of the rare passerby. In the poor light, it was hard to be sure, but I believed Corinna was already beginning to flake away. I'd never seen a dead vampire in the rain before.
"I thought Bruno was such a great fighter. How come you didn't take him on?"
"I gave you the knife," Pam said, giving me a good imitation of surprise. "He didn't have a knife."
"Right," I coughed, and boy did that hurt my throat. "So what do we do now?"
"We're getting out of here," Pam said. "We're going to hope that no one noticed my car. I think only 3 cars passed since we pulled over. With the rain and poor visibility, if the drivers were human, we have a very good chance that none of them will remember seeing us."
By then, we were back in Pam's car.
"Wouldn't it be better if we moved the Lexus?"
I said, wheezing out the words.
"What a good idea,"
Pam said, patting me on the head. "Do you think you can drive it?"
"Where to?"
Pam thought for a moment, which was good, because I needed the recovery time. I was soaked through and shivering, and I felt awful.
"Won't Victor know what's happened?"
I asked. I couldn't seem to stop asking questions.
"Maybe. He wasn't brave enough to do this himself, so he has to take the consequences. He's lost his 2 best people, and he has nothing to show for it."
Pam was enjoying the hell out of that.
"I think we get out of here right now, before some more of his people come to check or whatever."
I sure wasn't up for fighting again.
"It's you who keeps asking questions. I think Eric will be here soon. I'd better call him to tell him to stay away," Pam said. She looked faintly worried.
"Why?"
"I would have loved to have Eric appear to take charge of this situation, frankly."
"If someone is watching his house, and he leaps into his car and drives in this direction to come rescue you, it'll be a pretty clear indication that we're responsible for what happened to Bruno and Corinna," Pam said, clearly exasperated. "Use your brain, Sookie."
"My brain is all soggy," I said, and if I sounded a little testy, I don't think that's any big amazing thing.
But Pam was already hitting a speed dial number on her cell. I could hear Eric yelling when he answered the phone. Pam said,
"Shut up and I'll explain. Of course she lives."
There was silence. Pam summed up the situation in a few pithy phrases, and she concluded with,
"Go somewhere it's reasonable to be going in a hurry. Back to the bar in answer to some crisis, to the all-night dry cleaners to pick up your suits, to the store to pick up some True Blood. Don't lead them here."
After a squawk or two, Eric apparently saw the sense in what Pam was saying. I couldn't hear his voice clearly, though he was still talking to her.
"Her throat will be bruised," Pam said impatiently. "Yes, she killed Bruno herself." "All right, I'll tell her."
Pam turned to me. "He's proud of you," she said with some disgust.
"Pam gave me the knife," I croaked. I knew he could hear me.
"But it was Sookie's idea to move the car,"
Pam said, with the air of someone who's going to be fair if it kills her.
I'm trying to think of where to put it. The truck stops will have security cameras. I think we'll leave it on the shoulder, well past the bon ton exit.
That's what we did. Pam had some towels in her trunk, and I put them down on the seat of Bruno's car. Pam poked around in his ashes to retrieve the Lexus key, and after looking over the instrument panel, I figured I could drive it. I followed Pam for 40 minutes, staring longingly at the bon ton sign as we sped past it. I pulled over to the shoulder right after Pam did. Following Pam's instructions, I left the key in the car, wiped off the steering wheel with the towels, which were damp from their contact with me, and then scuttled to Pam's car and climbed in. It was still raining, by the way.
Then we had to return to my house. By then, I was aching in every joint and a little sick to my stomach. Finally, we pulled up to my back door. To my amazement, Pam leaned over to give me a hug.
"You did very well," she said. "You did what had to be done."
For once, she didn't look as if she were secretly laughing at me.
"I hope this all turns out to be worth it,"
I said, sounding as gloomy and exhausted as I felt.
"We're still alive, so it was worth it," Pam said.
I couldn't argue with that, though something within me wanted to. I climbed out of her car and trudged across the dripping backyard. The rain had finally stopped. Claude opened the back door as I reached it. He had opened his mouth to say something, but when he took in my condition, he closed it again. He shut the door behind me, and I heard him lock it.
"I'm going to shower," I said, "and then I'm going to bed. Good night, Claude."
"Good night, Sookie,"
he said very quietly, and then he shut up. I appreciated that more than I could say. When I got into work the next day at 11, Sam was dusting all the bottles behind the bar.
"Good morning,"
he said, staring at me.
"You look like hell warmed over."
"Thanks, Sam. Good to know I'm looking my best." Sam turned red.
"Sorry, Sookie. You always look good. I was just thinking
about the big circles under my eyes." I pulled down the skin of my cheeks, making a hideous face for his benefit. "I was real late getting in last night. I had to kill someone and move his car. I had to go over to Shreveport to see Eric."
"Business or pleasure?"
And he ducked his head, clearly not believing he'd said that either.
"Oh, I'm sorry, Sookie. My mom would say I got up on the tactless side of the bed today."
I gave him a half hug. "Don't worry. Every day is like that for me. And I have to apologize to you. I'm sorry I've been so ignorant about the legal trouble facing shifters and wares right now." It was definitely time for me to look at the big picture.
"You had some good reasons to concentrate on yourself the past few weeks," Sam said. "I don't know that I could have recovered the way you have. I'm real proud of you."
I didn't know what to say. I looked down at the bar, reached for a cloth to polish away a ring.
"If you need me to start a petition or call my state representative, you just say the word," I told him. "No one should make you register anywhere. You're an American, born and bred."
"That's the way I look at it. It's not like I'm any different from the way I've always been. The only difference is that now people know about it."
"How did the pack run go?" "I'd almost forgotten about it."
"They seem to have a good time, far as I can tell," I said cautiously. "I met Annabelle and the new guy, Basim."
"Why is Alcide beefing up the ranks? Have you heard anything about what's been happening in the Longtooth pack?"
"Well, I told you I've been dating one of them," he said, looking away at the bottles behind the bar as if he were trying to spot one that was still dusty.
If this conversation continued in the same vein, the whole bar would be spanking clean. "Who would that be?" Since this was the second time he'd mentioned it, I figured it was okay for me to ask. His fascination with the bottles was transferred to the cash register.
Janilyn? Janilyn Hopper?"
"Oh," I said in a neutral way. I was trying to give myself a little time to make my face bland and receptive.
"She was there the night we fought the pack that was trying to take over. She, took care of the wounded enemies."
That was an extreme euphemism. She cracked their skulls with her clenched fists. Trying to prove that it wasn't National Tactless Day at my house, I said,
Oh, yes. The, very slim girl. The young one.
She's not as young as she looks, Sam said, bypassing the obvious fact that her age was not the first issue one could have with Janilyn.
Okie dokie. How old is she?
21.
Oh, well, she's quite a girl, I said solemnly. I forced a smile to my lips. Seriously, Sam, I'm not judging your choice.
Not much.
Janilyn's really, really, she's dynamic.
Thanks, he said, his face clearing. She gave me a call after we fought in the pack war. She's into lions.
Sam had changed into a lion that night, the better to fight. He'd made a magnificent king of beasts. So, how long have you two been dating?
We've been talking for a while, but we went out for the first time maybe 3 weeks ago.
Well, that's great, I said. I made myself relax and smile more naturally. You sure you don't need a note from her mom?
Sam threw the dustcloth at me. I grabbed it and threw it back.
Can you two quit playing? I need to talk to Sam, Tanya said. She'd come in without my hearing her. She's never going to be my best friend, but she's a good worker, and she's willing to come in 2 evenings a week after she gets off her day job at Norcross. You want me to leave? I asked. No, that's okay.
Sorry, Tanya. What do you need? Sam asked, smiling.
I need you to change my name on my paychecks, Tanya said. You changed your name?
I must have been extra slow that day. But Sam would have said it if I hadn't. He looked just as blank.
Yeah, me and Calvin went to a courthouse across the state line in Arkansas and got married, she said. I'm Tanya Norris now.
Sam and I both stared at Tanya in a moment of silent astonishment.
Congratulations, I said heartily. I know you'll be real happy.
I wasn't so sure about Calvin being happy, but at least I managed to say something nice.
Sam chimed in, too, with all the right things. Tanya showed us her wedding ring, a broad gold band, and after going into the kitchen to show it to Antoine and Derek, she left as abruptly as she'd arrived to drive back to work at Norcross. She'd mentioned they'd registered at Target and Walmart for the few things they needed, so Sam dashed into his office and picked out a wall clock to give them from all the Merlot's employees. He put a jar out by the bar for our contributions, and I dropped in a 10. By that time, people were coming in for lunch, and I had to get busy. I never did get around to asking you some questions, I said to Sam. Maybe before I leave work?
Sure, Sook,
he said, and began filling glasses with iced tea. It was a warm day. After I'd served drinks and food for about an hour, I was surprised to see Claude coming through the door. Even in rumpled clothes he'd obviously picked up off the floor to pull on, he looked breathtakingly gorgeous. He'd pulled his hair back into a messy ponytail, and it didn't detract. It was almost enough to make you hate him, really. Claude slouched over to me as if he were in Merlot's every day, and as if his kind and tactful moment last night had never been.
The water heater's not working, he said.
Hi, Claude. Good to see you, I said. Did you sleep well? I'm so glad. I slept well, too. I guess you better do something about the water heater, huh? If you want to shower and wash your clothes. Remember me asking you to help me out by handling some things I can't? You could call Hank Clearwater. He's come out to the house before.
I can go have a look, a voice said.
I turned to see Terry Balfleur standing behind me. Terry is a Vietnam War vet, and he's got some awful scars, both the kind you can see and the kind you can't. He'd been very young when he'd gone to war. He'd been very old when he returned. His auburn hair was graying, but it was still thick and long enough to braid. I'd always gotten along real well with Terry, who could do just about anything around the yard or in the house by way of repairs.
I would sure appreciate it, I said, but I don't want to take advantage, Terry.
He'd always been kind to me. He'd cleared away the debris of my burned kitchen so the builders could start working on the new one, and I'd had to insist he take a fair wage for it.
No problem,
he muttered, his eyes on his old work boots. Terry survived on a monthly government check and on several odd jobs. For example, he came into Merlot's either very late at night or early in the morning to clean the tables and the bathrooms and to mop the floors.
He always said keeping busy kept him fit, and it was true that Terry was still built.
I'm Claude Crane, Sookie's cousin. Claude held out his hand to Terry.
Terry muttered his own name and took Claude's hand. His eyes came up to meet Claude's. Terry's eyes were unexpectedly beautiful, a rich golden brown and heavily lashed. I'd never noticed before. I realized I'd never thought about Terry as a man before. After the handshake, Terry looked startled. When he was faced with something out of his normal path, usually Terry reacted badly. The only question was of degree. But at the moment, Terry seemed more puzzled than frightened or angry.
Did you want me to come look at it now? Terry asked. I have a couple of hours free.
That would be wonderful, Claude said. I want my shower and I want a hot one. He smiled at Terry.
Dude, I'm not gay, Terry said,
and the expression on Claude's face was priceless. I'd never seen Claude nonplussed before.
Thanks, Terry. I'd sure appreciate it, I said briskly. Claude's got a key, and he'll let you in. If you have to buy some parts, just give me the receipts. You know I'm good for it.
I might have to transfer some money from my savings to my checking, but I still had what I thought of as my vampire money safely stashed at the bank. And Mr. Cataliades would be sending me poor Claudine's money, too. Something relaxed inside me every time I thought about that bit of money. I'd been balanced on the fine edge of poverty so many times that I was used to it, and the knowledge of that money I'd be able to sock in the bank was a huge relief to me. Terry nodded and then went out the back door to get his pickup. I speared Claude with a scowl.
That man is very fragile, I said. He had a bad war. Just remember that.
Claude's face was slightly flushed.
I'll remember, he said. I've been in wars myself.
He gave me another quick graze on the cheek to show me he'd recovered from the blow to his pride. I could feel the envy of every woman in the bar beating against me.
I'll be gone to Monroe by the time you get home, I suppose. Thanks, cousin.
Sam came to stand beside me as Claude went out the door.
Elvis has left the building, he said
dryly.
No, I haven't seen him in a while,
I said, definitely on auto mouth. Then I shook myself.
Sorry, Sam. Claude's one of a kind, isn't he?
I haven't seen Claudine in a while. She's a lot of fun, Sam said. Claude seems to be more typical of the general run of fairies.
There was a question in his voice.
We won't be seeing Claudine anymore, I said. As far as I know, we won't be seeing any fairies but Claude.
The doors are shut, however that works. Though I understand there's still one or two lurking around my house.
There's a lot you haven't told me, he said.
We need to catch up, I agreed.
What about this evening, after you get off? Terry's supposed to come back and do some repairs that have piled up around here, but Kennedy is scheduled to take the bar.
Sam looked a little worried.
I hope Claude doesn't make another pass at Terry. Claude's ego is as big as a barn, and Terry's so... You never know how he's going to take stuff.
Terry's a grown man, I reminded Sam. Of course, I was trying to reassure myself. They both are.
Claude isn't a man at all, Sam said, though he's a male.
It was a huge relief when I noticed Terry'd returned an hour later. He seemed absolutely normal, not flustered or angry or anything else. I had always tried to keep out of Terry's head because it could be a very frightening place. Terry did well as long as he kept his focus on one thing at a time. He thought about his dogs a lot. He kept one of the puppies from his bitch's last litter, and he was training the youngster. In fact, if ever a dog was taught to read, Terry would be the man who'd done it. After he'd worked on a loose doorknob in Sam's office, Terry sat at one of my tables and ordered a salad and some sweet tea. After I took his order, Terry silently handed me a receipt. He'd had to get a new element for the water heater.
It's all fixed now, he said. Your cousin was able to get his hot shower.
Thanks, Terry, I said. I'm going to give you something for your time and labor.
Not a problem, Terry said. Your cousin took care of that.
He turned his attention to his magazine. He'd brought a copy of Louisiana Hunting and Fishing to read while he waited for his food. I wrote Terry a check for the element and gave it to him when I brought his food.
He nodded and slipped it in his pocket. Since Terry's schedule meant he wasn't always available to fill in, Sam had hired another bartender so he could have some regular evenings off. The new bartender, who'd been at work for a couple of weeks, was really pretty in a supersized way. Kennedy Keyes was 5'11 easy, taller than Sam for sure. She had the kind of good looks you associate with traditional beauty queens, shoulder-length chestnut hair with discreet blonde highlights, wide brown eyes, a white and even smile that was an orthodontist's wet dream. Her skin was perfect, her back straight, and she'd graduated from Southern Arkansas University with a degree in psychology. She'd also done time. Sam had asked her if she wanted a job when she drifted in for lunch the day after she'd gotten out of jail. She hadn't even asked what she'd be doing before she'd said yes. He'd given her a basic bartender's guide, and she'd studied every spare moment until she'd mastered an amazing number of drinks.
"Sookie,"
she said, as if we'd been best friends since childhood. That was Kennedy's way.
"How you doing?"
"Good, thank you. Yourself?"
"Happy as a clam."
She bent to check the number of sodas in the glass-fronted refrigerator behind the bar.
"We need us some A&W,"
she said.
"Coming right up."
I got the keys from Sam, then went back to the stockroom to find a case of root beer. I got 2 6-packs.
"I didn't mean you to get that. I could have gotten them."
Kennedy smiled at me. Her smile was kind of perpetual.
"I appreciate it."
"No problem."
"Do I look any smaller, Sookie?"
she said hopefully. She half turned to show me her butt and looked at me over her own shoulder. Kennedy's issue didn't seem to be that she had been in jail, but that she had put on weight in jail. The food had been crappy, she'd told me, and it had been high on the carbohydrate count.
"But I'm an emotional eater," she'd said, as if that were a terrible thing. "And I was real emotional in jail."
Ever since she'd gotten back to Bon Ton, she'd been anxious to return to her beauty queen measurements. She was still beautiful. There was just more of her to look good.
"You're gorgeous as always," I said.
I looked around for Danny Prideaux. Sam had asked Danny to come in when Kennedy was working at night. This arrangement was supposed to last for a month, until Sam was sure people wouldn't take advantage of Kennedy.
"You know,"
she said, interpreting my glance,
"I can handle myself."
Everyone in Bon Ton knew that Kennedy could handle herself, and that was the problem. Her reputation might constitute a challenge to certain men who were assholes.
"I know you can," I said mildly.
Danny Prideaux was insurance. And there he came through the door. He was taller than Kennedy by a couple of inches, and he was of some racial mixture that I hadn't figured out. Danny had deep olive skin, short brown hair, and a broad face. He'd been out of the army for a month, and he hadn't yet settled into a career of any sort. He worked part-time at the home builder's supply store. He was willing enough to be a bouncer for a few nights a week, especially since he got to look at Kennedy the whole time. Sam drifted out of his office to say goodnight and brief Kennedy on a customer whose check had bounced, and then he and I went out the back door together.
"Let's go to Crawdad Diner," he suggested.
That sounded good to me. It was an old restaurant just off the square around the courthouse. Like all the businesses in the area around the square, the oldest part of Bon Ton, the diner had a history. The original owners had been Perdita and Crawdad Jones, who'd opened the restaurant in the 40s. When Perdita had retired, she'd sold the business to Charles E. Tooten's husband, Ralph, who'd quit his job at the chicken processing plant to take over. Their deal was that Perdita would give Ralph all her recipes if he'd agree to keep the name Crawdad Diner. When Ralph's arthritis had forced him to retire, he'd sold Crawdad Diner to Pinky Arnett with the same condition. So generations of Bon Ton diners were insured of getting the best bread pudding in the state, and the heirs of Perdita and Crawdad Jones were able to point with pride. I told Sam this bit of local history after we'd ordered country fried steak with green beans and rice.
"Thank God Pinky got the bread pudding recipe, and when the green tomatoes are in season, I want to come in every other night to have them fried," Sam said.
"How's living with your cousin?"
He squeezed his lemon slice into his tea. "I hardly know yet. He just moved in some stuff, and we haven't had a lot of overlap."
"Have you seen him strip?"
Sam laughed.
"I mean, professionally. I sure couldn't do that on a stage with people watching."
Physically, there sure wouldn't be anything stopping him. I'd seen Sam naked when he changed from a shifter form into human. Yum.
No, I always planned on going with Amelia, but since she went back to New Orleans, I haven't been in a strip club kind of mood.
You should ask Claude for a job on your nights off, I said, grinning.
Oh, sure, he said sarcastically, but he looked pleased.
We talked about Amelia's departure for a while, and then I asked Sam about his family in Texas.
My mom's divorce came through, he said. Of course, my stepdad's been in jail since he shot her, so she hasn't seen him in months. At this point, I'm guessing the main difference to her is going to be financial. She's getting my dad's military pension, but she doesn't know if her job at the school will be waiting for her or not when the summer's over. They hired a substitute for the rest of the school year after she got shot, and they're waffling over having Mom back.
Before she'd gotten shot, Sam's mom had been the receptionist slash secretary at an elementary school. Not everyone was calm about having a woman who turned into an animal working in the same office as them, though Sam's mom was the same woman she'd been before. I was baffled by this attitude.
The waitress brought our plates and a basket of rolls. I sighed with anticipated pleasure. This was much nicer than cooking for myself.
Any news on Craig's wedding?
I asked, when I could yank myself away from my country fried steak.
They finished couples counseling, he said with a shrug. Now her parents want them to have genetics counseling, whatever that is.
That's nuts.
Some people just think anything different is bad, Sam said as he buttered his second roll. And it's not like Craig could change.
As the firstborn of a pure shifter couple, only Sam felt the call of the moon.
I'm sorry, I shook my head. I know the situation's hard on everyone in your family.
He nodded.
My sister Mindy's gotten over it pretty well. She let me play with the kids the last time I saw them, and I'm going to try to get over to Texas for the 4th of July. Her town has a big fireworks display, and the whole family goes. I think I'd enjoy it.
I smiled. They were lucky to have Sam and their family. That was what I thought. Your sister must be pretty smart, I said.
I took a big bite of country fried steak with milk gravy. It was blissful.
He laughed. Listen, while we're talking family, he said, you ready to tell me how you're really doing? You told me about your great-grandfather and what happened. How are your injuries? I don't want to sound like I expect you to tell me everything that goes on in your life, but you know I care.
I did a little hesitating myself, but it felt right to tell Sam. So I tried to give him a nutshell account of the past week. And J.B. has been helping me with some physical therapy, I added.
You're walking like nothing happened unless you get tired, he observed.
There's a couple of bad patches on my left upper thigh where the flesh actually... Okay, not going there.
I looked down at my napkin for a minute or two.
It grew back, mostly. There's a kind of dimple. I have a few scars, but they're not terrible. Eric doesn't seem to mind.
In fact, he had a scar or two from his human life, though they hardly showed against the whiteness of his skin.
Are you, coping okay with it?
I have nightmares sometimes, I confessed. And I have some panic moments. But let's not talk about it anymore,